You're listening to Keystone Cold Cases, a podcast where we reignite cold cases across Pennsylvania.
New York State is alive with stories to tell, from true crime to dark history and the paranormal. New York's Dark Side podcast aims to bring you stories from all around New York State. I'm Amanda Morgan, your host, bringing you tales that you may have never heard before, such as the one of a state-funded school for persons with disabilities that had ties to human experimentation, an urban legend, and an alleged serial killer, or of the mysterious disappearance of a Supreme Court judge that shocked the nation, earning him the title of the most missingest missing man in America, or of how a fake news story regarding the Central Park Zoo sparked terror in New York City and helped influence the elephant and donkey used to depict America's two major political parties today. I have episodes geared to satisfy your curious side and so much more yet to come. New episodes post weekly on Sundays, and you can listen to past episodes now, ad-free, wherever you get your podcasts. I hope you stay curious.
Hey, this is Caitlin.
Hey, it's Ed.
Hey, it's Janelle.
Hey, it's Melissa. Well, welcome. You're listening to Keystone Cold Cases. Couple quick reminders. One, our Patreon is live for $5 a month. You get to spend extra quality time with us.
Which is pretty exciting. It's priceless, actually. It may be $5 a month, but it's actually priceless.
And second of all, you know, if you're enjoying this, if you can throw us a 5-star review on Apple or Spotify or Amazon, wherever you listen, we'd appreciate it. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook, TikTok, Instagram at KCC Podcast. Does anyone have any other housekeeping to go over before we start?
No.
I'm good.
I'm good.
All right. Well, tonight my case is continuing with the Scranton Five. This is victim number 4 of 5, and this case is technically still unsolved, the one I'm covering tonight. We do have a possible suspect who we talked about in the first three cases. We talked about Shelley Ludi was a victim, Joanne Williams was a victim, and Laureen Finn was a victim. That suspect and convicted child rapist and murderer is Frank Ossolani. We don't know if he committed the first four of these crimes. We do know he committed the fifth one, which I will be covering probably on our Patreon in the next couple of months. So stay tuned for that. So even if Frank didn't do all of these crimes, I mean, he's dead now, a convicted child rapist and murderer. So I think we can all agree that regardless of if he's responsible for the other crimes, he's definitely, his actions are reprehensible and he's grotesque. So we hate him.
And he didn't exactly do anything to put himself in a better position in the eyes of law enforcement. I mean, this guy didn't do himself any favors, I guess I'm saying.
He definitely did not. He's like a trash-eating maggot. That's like offensive to maggots. I feel bad. All right, so this case will definitely make you question Frank's involvement. Before I start, I do want to mention a trigger warning for child abuse. We are covering it all, emotional, physical, and sexual abuse. So if that's not something you feel you can listen to, we totally get it. And I urge you to either skip this episode and tune in again for the next one, or maybe just skip the parts. I will give a trigger warning right before I cover that stuff. So today our case is about 11-year-old Michelle Jolene Lakey. Her first name's Michelle, but she went by Jolene a lot, so I probably will go back and forth between the two names, but I'm referring to Michelle Jolene. Michelle was born on October 21st, 1974, to Isaac and Lois Lakey. Isaac also went by Woody. Michelle was living with her mother and her mother's husband at the time of her disappearance. And from what I could gather, I think she was part of 8 siblings. So I believe she had 4 step-siblings and then 3 full siblings.
That was really common, so, I think, back then, of just a lot of kids. I don't see that as much anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a lot of kids, and they lived in a very small place, and it was 10 people in this small little home, so it was very chaotic.
Do you think that's a generational thing? Do you think just this generation doesn't enjoy these massive families like it used to exist?
I mean, I'm certainly happy with just my dogs and husband, so.
I think it's a generational thing, for sure.
I definitely do, too. I have two kids, and that's my limit, personally.
Agreed.
Well, I also think birth control is more available, so.
True.
Thank God for that.
Yeah.
At the time of Michelle's disappearance, which was 1986, her father, Isaac Woody Lakey, had been estranged from his family for several years. And I have to just go by several years because sources differed from him being gone from like 3 years all the way up to 10 years. So we're just going to say several years.
Do we know why he was estranged or what happened to make him estranged?
We don't know. I couldn't find anything on that. We'll get into it later. But yeah, I couldn't find anything on why he left.
Okay.
So Michelle Jolene was adorable. She was the cutest little girl. She gave me like young Alyssa Milano vibes, like the Who's the Boss era. And she was so cute. And from reading articles about her, she was definitely beautiful inside and out. She was the center of attention. She had this beautiful smile, her crazy clothes, and she had a super energetic personality. Apparently, she loved wearing mismatched and clashing clothing, which, like, yes, girl, that's awesome. Apparently, I listened to an interview with her sister, and her sister, Justine Forsythe, who is freaking amazing. The woman is so strong and just so inspiring to listen to. But Justine was talking about how Michelle was super outrageous, and she, quote, lived out loud, end quote, which I thought was like a really cool way to describe her sister. Like, I've never heard somebody being called like lived out loud, but I think it's really sweet.
I just looked up a picture
Michelle
of her.
Michelle was never.
She's super cute. I just looked up a picture.
Isn't she so she cute? So she's so pretty.
Oh, that's a great description, you too. See? Young Alyssa Milano.
Yes. It's like, who's the boss? I love it. I read that Michelle Jolene was never afraid to speak her mind, regardless of the trouble it caused, to which I say, yes, girl, get it. Caused problems. She was also an animal lover and was apparently always bringing home stray animals. And you know how I feel about animal lovers. They're automatically wonderful. At the time of her disappearance, school was out for summer break because it was August 26th when she disappeared. But she would have been entering the sixth grade that fall. So on Tuesday, August 26, 1986, Michelle had been visiting her mother, Lois, at Mercy Hospital in Scranton, which it's still there, but it's been renamed the Commonwealth Health Regional Hospital. Lois had been admitted to the hospital the day prior due to GI issues. Same girl, same. So Michelle visited and hung out with her mom for a while, and when Michelle left the hospital, it was about 5 p.m., and she began heading towards home, and she was walking with a friend of hers. Now, I don't know if the friend was at the hospital with her or if they bumped into each other. Sources were really not clear. It just said she was with her friend. One article stated that she visited her mom and had told her mom that when she left the hospital, she was going to go home. She was going to get her belongings to sleep over at a friend's house. Then before she went to the friend's house, she was going to stop back at the hospital to see her mom and say goodnight. But unfortunately, she never made it home, let alone to the friend's house.
This is so eerily similar to a couple of the other Scranton Five. Just
right?
Gone. Gone.
The whole thing is very strange.
You said she was walking with a friend?
Yes. Yep. So
what happened with the friend?
They do split up at some point.
Oh, okay.
But again, that's unknown because then she bumps into another friend who she does talk to for a few minutes. So back to her walk home. She didn't make it home. She didn't make it to the friend's house. According to an article in the Scranton Times Tribune, at about 8:30 that night, remember, she left the hospital at 5. So at about 8:30 that night, Lois received a phone call in the hospital from the mom of the friend where she was supposed to sleep over at. And the mom was concerned and she's like, hey, like, is Michelle with you? And she wasn't. So, of course, this set off alarm bells for everyone. And actually, a small group of family, the kids, started looking for Michelle. It was later that night that they did call the Scranton police to report her missing.
I do love the kind of quick response by everyone. Like, you see so many cases where it's like somebody goes, and usually it doesn't happen as much with kids, but somebody goes missing and they're like, they'll come back. And they wait a couple of these guys were like right on it.
Well, hold that thought.
Oh, never mind.
This case is a real bummer, and it honestly really almost has nothing to do with Frank. So just hold that thought about this, about the early, like...
I'll take it back for now.
The word. Yes, take it back.
Okay, and I may say it again later.
Fair. All right, so let's talk about our walk home. According to Google Maps, and of course I'm looking at Google Maps today, not in 1986... So if you're walking from the hospital to where Michelle lived, there's a few routes that she could have taken. All of them would have been about 20 minutes. However, on Google Maps, you can see like yards where she could have cut through. So that could have shortened it. But if we're going down the road per what the route we think she took, it would have been about 20 minutes from the hospital to her house. And the most direct route would have been to leave the hospital, walk down Jefferson Ave, and turn left on Myrtle Street, and then walk a few blocks to North Washington Ave, which is where she lived. So we think she took this route because we know she talked to a friend at the corner of Myrtle Street and North Washington Ave. So she talked, so at some point, the other friend she was with split off. And when she got to Myrtle Street and North Washington Ave, so the corner that she lived at, she met a friend and they started talking.
Did you get any sense when you looked at Google Maps how big these streets were? Like, are we talking four-lane roads or are we talking, like, backcountry roads?
No, it's like, I mean, it's Scranton, which I think is considered a city, but it's very small. And, I mean, they all looked like regular two-lane roads.
Okay. So I guess my question is this the same friend that was at the hospital? Because we say that she met a friend at the corner of this street, but there was also a friend at the hospital. Is it the same friend? Mm-hmm.
No, the friend at the hospital and her split up at some point, and this is like a different friend that she met at the corner. She just bumped into her.
Okay.
So I got the sense that, you know, it was kind of, I mean, it was the 80s, so I'm sure kids were out at all times. Mm-hmm. You probably didn't know where your kid was a lot of the time, and it was like, just be home when it gets dark.
So the time frame has to be pretty tight then for her to run into two friends on the way home and still go missing.
If you think about a 20-minute walk, and then they saw her at the corner of her street.
Do we know anything about these friends?
No, we have no idea. I think they were just her classmates.
Okay.
So after she spoke to the friend at the corner of Myrtle and North Washington, you know, she broke off from her and she continued walking home. Later, witnesses came forward to report that she was seen talking to someone driving a light yellow car. Some of the witnesses claim she got in the car, but, like, she was only a block from home, so I don't know why she would get in someone's car when she had a clear, like, path of what she was doing. I'm going home, I'm getting my stuff, I'm going back to see my mom, and I'm going to my friends. So I don't know why she would get in this person's car when we know she had, like, a set plan to abide by.
This was before she got her stuff? From home.
Yeah, she never made it home.
The whole situation is so bizarre because it has elements of, like, we hear about people vanishing, they're out for a walk on one of these roads and they're just gone. This has like three or four witnesses. Like it's like there's still so many questions about what actually happened, but there's so many people that could have seen something. It's a really bizarre situation.
But see, my first thought was, isn't witness, like, eyewitness testimony, like, the least reliable kind of testimony? Like, don't they always say that witnesses botch things up all the time? And what's a light yellow car? Could that be a tan car to you and a light green car to Janelle and a bright yellow car to Kate? Like, how do we know what a light yellow car was? I feel like that could be so many things.
And what time of day was it? 8:30?
No. This was between probably 5:15 and 5:45. If she left her mom at 5 and it was about a 20-minute walk, depending on how long.
How heavy was the traffic then? I mean, because I think 5:15 to 5:45 is like, and nowadays it'd be like rush hour traffic. People are trying to get home and all of that stuff. But I'm sure in that time it may not have been the same thing.
I don't know, but I kind of got the impression that this was more like of a neighborhood area.
Okay.
And I mean, again, it was 86, so I wouldn't be able to look up the traffic patterns, but I kind of got the impression that it wasn't, you know, it's like it's a city, but it's also residential area. So I don't think the streets she was on were super duper busy.
Yeah, it's not like a city where there's like skyscrapers, but it's kind of like, you know, like a suburb town. Like, I would say Scranton's similar to like a suburb town, an urban area, but not like a Philadelphia city, but maybe like Norristown.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that intersection's at a T. It's weird.
Yes. It is, like, are you looking it up?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and she lived like right down North Washington Ave, so she was not far from her home. If what the witnesses are saying is true, she was not at all far from her home. And I'll talk about this later, but to this day, we have no idea who could have been driving that light yellow car.
You would think?
Go ahead.
I was going to say, you would think maybe it's somebody she knew if she was talking to them for a bit and felt comfortable getting in the car, being so close to home.
I have a question. Yeah. Is this a missing or murdered case?
She's missing.
Okay.
We have no idea where she is.
Okay.
All right, so backing up. So I read in an article, and I didn't write this down, so I do need to source it. But I read in an article that not long before all this happened, at Michelle Jolene's school, they had an assembly, and it was kind of like a stranger danger thing. And they said, you know, if you ever see a car, you don't want to get in it. And supposedly she actually stood up and said, I would never get in the car with a stranger.
Wow.
So, you know, that makes me think that if she really did, which I think that's a big if, I'm not sold on her getting in this car. But if she did get in the car, I think we can agree that it was someone she knew. But again, if she was that close to home, where was she going? And it's not like she could have been getting a ride to her friends because she still had to go home and get her stuff.
So the witness claimed she got into the car, or just that she was talking to someone driving a car? So I guess it was both.
A couple witnesses said both. All right. So before we get to suspects, and I do have a little bit more to talk about before we get there, but this is where the trigger warning is going to come in. I don't particularly want to discuss this, but I think that we need to. So let me start with another trigger warning for abuse of minors, mental abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse. That's not something you want to hear. I get it. I suggest you either turn us off now or skip ahead about 4.5 minutes to where I start talking about kind of the investigation and then the suspects. So we'll give you a few seconds to skip. All right, so this information is coming straight from Michelle's sister, Justine. She did an interview with a podcast called Crime Pursuit. I believe the host's name is Ed Bounds. He's amazing. He's got a great voice. He does great research. I highly recommend that podcast. It's called Crime Pursuit. I listened to it on Apple, so I'm sure you can find it anywhere. But in this interview, Justine discussed the horrific abuse that she and her siblings went through at the hands of their mother / stepmother, Lois. Again, Justine's just amazing and so strong to not only have survived this abuse, but to be able to talk about it. She discussed how the 8 children were almost always left alone at home. They frequently went without breakfast and dinner, surviving only on their school lunches. Lois rarely worked outside of the home, and it doesn't sound like she did much in the home. She delegated all of the house chores to the 8 children, and I don't just mean, like, make your bed, clean your room. I'm talking cooking, cleaning, taking out the trash, being the adult in the house, these poor children. Lois frequently physically abused the children by beating them, slamming their heads into walls. Justine talks about a time she slammed her head into a tree. So much more. The kids often went to school hungry. They had black eyes, bruises. According to Justine, all 8 kids were sexually abused by their uncle, which actually resulted in one of the children, this little girl who was 11 at the time, getting pregnant by her uncle, 11 years old.
That's insane.
The uncle was bisexual and he abused all the children, male, female, it didn't matter. This poor 11-year-old did get an abortion, but...
To be 11 years old and have to, one, suffer this, two, suffer an abortion,
I can't even imagine.
Awful.
Can you guys woman-splain something to me?
Sure.
Can you get pregnant at 11? I mean, I guess you can, but...
Puberty.
That's,
yes.
Depends. So, depends when you hit puberty.
I didn't know you could hit puberty at 11.
I think 11 is young.
Yeah, my daughter hit 11. It, and she's 9 and a half.
Oh.
That's insane.
Yeah, so this poor child, I mean, to go through so much at 11. Like, you're a baby.
Unreal.
So is so the uncle the guy who's the suspect, or is that a different guy?
No, the uncle, I don't even know his name. Honestly, I didn't want to give him any more time than I had to. I do believe he was Lois's brother. At some point, the kids were removed from Lois's custody, but were returned only 9 months later, so I don't know what the point of that was. There was just so much abuse, not only by Lois and that disgusting garbage can of an uncle, but also by other family members. These kids did not get a break. I mean, they went through hell, really at the hands of the person who's supposed to, like, love them more than anyone in the world, their frigging mom.
Was this abuse from, like, Lois's family? Is it Lois's family that did the abuse?
Yes. As far as I know,
what do we know about Lois's family? What?
Not much, honestly. Okay. I know that the aunt, again, I didn't write this down, so I don't want to fully commit to it, but I know that later on in the investigation, there was kind of like word that her aunt was like tipping off the media of where they were gonna be and just all this bullshit that you just don't do when you have a missing family member. Mm-mm. And Kate, for your question, so Lois was the mother of Justine and Michelle Jolene, and then the 11-year-old who had gotten raped by her uncle, but then she was the stepmother to her husband's 4 children.
Oh, okay.
So she was both mom and step. I mean, she was like the evil stepmother. So these poor kids, they just went through so much and they were just failed by everyone. Their teachers, police, neighbors. I mean, no one did anything about the horrible conditions these kids were subjected to. This part's really messed up. Justine also talked about how when she and her female siblings turned 11, their mother would find them boyfriends. And I don't mean like another boy at school to eat lunch with. I mean, like, teenagers, older teenagers, 18 years old. That's a fucking adult. Justine actually even went to Planned Parenthood to pick up condoms when her mom got her the, quote, boyfriend. I'm just going to say rapist, because that's what it is.
Just say it. Call it like it is.
Exactly. So, you know, she was terrified of getting pregnant by the boyfriend rapist. I mean, and here's another thing. Like, how did no one at Planned Parenthood think, why is this 11-year-old coming in for condoms? I mean, yes, we want everyone to be safe, but wouldn't that set off a red flag? Like, something is really wrong here.
It also might be a product of the era. Sad to say. I mean, it was the late 80s. So, I mean, things were...
80s different.
80s were funny, yeah.
Yeah.
Was it all of them going to pick up condoms, or was it like the oldest sibling?
No, it was just Justine. Like when she turned 11 and her mom found her a rapist, she went to Planned Parenthood because she was smart enough to know, like, I could get pregnant and I don't want that to happen. So I really felt it necessary to bring the abuse up because Justine did say in that interview on Crime Pursuit that she and her siblings often have wondered if their mother had anything to do with Michelle Jolene's disappearance. And I think that's a fair assumption. She talked about how she and her siblings were not allowed to speak to the police. She also mentioned that when she did speak to the police, when Lois was still in the hospital, they showed her a picture of Michelle Jolene that Lois had given them. And Justine was super confused. She's like, why do you have that picture? That picture's like a couple years old. So she gave the police a super recent picture within like the last few weeks. When Lois found out about this, Justine was subjected to what she says, quote, the worst beating of her life, end quote. Which begs the questions, and you three are parents, why would you give an old picture of your child? Wouldn't you do everything in your power to make sure police had the most recent photo? What was she wearing? What did her hair look like that day? Why would you not provide that?
It's not even a question, and I want to retract my earlier statement about the search party.
Told ya. I mean, like, I've actually heard of people who go to, like, Disney World, and before they get to the park, they take a picture of their child So if, God forbid, something were to happen,
yep,
they would be like, little Johnny was wearing an orange shirt, orange and blue sweatpants, blah, blah, blah. His hair was like this. He had his glasses on. Like, this is exactly what he looks like when I last saw him.
Right.
Not, here's his third grade picture. He's now going into sixth grade.
It's usually an obvious, I know everyone reacts differently to trauma and stuff, but I mean, it's usually a sign.
Oh yeah. And again, yes, there's, everyone reacts differently, but I mean, I'm not a parent and that's a piss poor way to react. Yeah. So the night Michelle disappeared, Ed, here's where we're getting to your comment. Mm. The night she disappeared, the kids were home alone per usual. They were left to fend for themselves, figure out their dinner, homework, all of that. The kids organized their own search party. The children, aww, these seven children, organized their own search party. I know at the time Justine was 13, so she like led the charge. Eventually, other families did join in. Family members joined in.
I would like to re-enter my earlier statement. What a great response and how quick.
With, but now it's just the by children, the kids.
So now we can differentiate. Yes. But yeah, what a good for them.
Yeah, I mean, that's amazing. I think that they knew they had to stick together. Like, Lois wasn't going to help. And apparently, the stepfather was not all there. He wasn't, he just wasn't very, like, in their life. He was there, but he wasn't.
It's giving me Shameless vibes. Like, the show, right? Shameless.
Right.
Like, that's, yes.
That's, like, what I picture in my mind of this, like, family of kids just, like, all working together.
I mean, they had to.
What, yeah, family members, like, you may not know this, what family members, like, joined the party? I mean, was it Lois's family? Any of them?
Yeah, because, I mean, the dad's family, I'm pretty sure, isn't, like, the dad wasn't in the picture. The biological father wasn't in the picture, and I don't believe his family was. So I do believe it was Lois's family. But again, this was later, like, after the kids tried to search on their own.
I'm just wondering if they were really helping or if they were just, like, bullshitting, to be honest.
I have no idea. I know. I wasn't going to bring this up either, but it's interesting because when I started doing the research for this case, I didn't read anything about the abuse. You know, it was all through newspapers and it was very like, she disappeared. These are the times. These are the streets. And that's that. I didn't start to hear about the abuse until I got into some more personal articles written and the podcast Crime Pursuit that I mentioned. So at first I was, didn't even know, you know, if I should discuss it, but I think it ultimately is a big part of the case and I think it needs to be talked about. So we for now are finished with the abuse. So if you skipped, this is where you want to start listening again. It seems like it was a really tough investigation right from the start, and other than search parties and a few witnesses coming forward, there wasn't really a lot of leads. They did have a few leads and suspects that we'll get into later, but you know, there wasn't like people coming out of the woodwork with stories. And so it made it really hard to investigate. In 1988, so the following 2 years later, she disappeared August 26, 1986. So in 1988, Trooper Walter P. Carlson with the PA State Police told the Tribune that the investigation was, quote, very active, end quote. He went on to explain that posters of Michelle Jolene had been hung up all over Scranton, which did help bring in phone calls, but again, it wasn't, like, concrete leads. They also spent, the police also spent a lot of time going through reports of missing people and Jane Doe's, you know, to see if Michelle Jolene's description matched up. On Friday, May 26, 1989, so not quite 3 years, but almost 3 years after she disappeared, police brought in a backhoe to dig up two separate locations in connection with Michelle Jolene and Joanne Williams, who was a missing person I covered back in December. The two locations that they dug up were off of Route 307, which is actually part of the Pennsylvania highway system running north-south for over 30 miles. They didn't specify where exactly, but I do know it was off of Route 307. I don't think anything was found, and if it was, it wasn't made known to the public. It is important to mention that in August of 1990, so 4 years after Michelle Jolene disappeared, one of Frank Ossolini's garages, like he had auto shops, one of his garages, the concrete floor was dug up. but again, nothing was found. And I'll go more into that when we finish the Scranton 5. That episode will be on the Patreon, so we'll go more into that. So also in 1990, divers were brought in to search Lake Wampaupack. A witness had come forward to say that they thought they had seen Michelle, Jolene, and Frank in the Lake Wampaupack area shortly after she disappeared. And another thing that may have prompted this search is that 1990 was also the year that Frank was convicted of murdering, raping, and murdering 9-year-old Renee Waddell, who she'll be the final Scranton 5 episode. But unfortunately, at Lake Wampaupack, it doesn't seem that anything was found in connection to Michelle or Frank. And sadly, this is really where the case kind of goes cold, at least reporting-wise. After this article in 1990, there wasn't really much mention of Michelle Jolene until really 2007, when a newspaper article brought the case up again. And I will say, in Scranton, they do mention this case quite often in just, you know, talking about it and reminding the public that this happened.
It's crazy they connect. Oh, yeah. Go ahead, Kate.
Lake Wampaupack is huge. Like, I would imagine it would be really hard to, like, totally comb that entire lake. It is, like, it's, like, ginormous. I go fishing there, like, every year and stay up there for a couple days, and it's a really, really big lake.
It always reminds me of the Office episode when they go on the booze cruise on Lake Wampaupack. All right, so let's move on to suspects. Suspect number one, the driver of the mysterious light yellow car. So, as I said earlier, witnesses came forward stating that they saw Michelle about a block from her home talking to the driver of a light yellow car and supposedly accepting a ride. Who the hell was driving this light yellow car? Who was she talking to? Did this car exist? Like, was she really talking to someone?
I agree with everyone that it was somebody who maybe knew her.
Yeah, I think so. What I wonder, and I think I say this later, but did Frank have a light yellow car? I didn't read anything that said he did or didn't, so I don't know.
That seems like that would be, if he did, the police would have jumped on that, given his connections to all his other girls, too.
Well, again, I bring this up later, but we'll just cover it now. He owned an auto body shop.
Right.
How do you know who he's driving? How do you know whose car he's driving? You know, like he could be like, I'm taking this out on a test run.
Right.
So another suspect in an article in the Scranton Times released on Saturday, September 13th, 1986. So less than a month after she disappeared, the police named a suspect in the New York area. Okay. So the police named a suspect in the New York area named, and I'm probably going to butcher this. I'm so sorry. Ian Basil Cicienda, who also went by John Chickenda. So I'm going to go with John. I think I wrote this Ian Basil Basil. Basil, who knows? John. This John guy was arrested actually the day prior, so I guess that would have been September 12th, 1986, in Brooklyn, New York, on a fugitive from justice warrant for the alleged rape of a 14-year-old from Scranton, which occurred sometime earlier in 1986. So in addition to the fugitive of justice, he was also being connected with charges of rape, involuntary deviant sexual intercourse, and other charges. So at first the police thought that John was somehow like related to Michelle's case, but that was later determined to be false. The only reason the two were even linked together was because people in the Brooklyn neighborhood were shown pictures of Michelle and they thought they had seen her, which again, there's eyewitness testimony. But a few days later, another article was released saying that they had not found Michelle Jolene in Brooklyn and they were abandoning this lead.
Can you, before we move on, just to clarify, what was his name again?
Shut up. His name was John.
Oh,
so,
okay.
Just John.
Thanks.
Basil, Basil, Ian, Ion, that
I've
guy.
I've never seen Ian spelled that way.
Me either.
Right? So I don't even know if it's Ian. At first I was saying Ion.
Well,
I thought it was an L and I thought it was loan.
Me too. I thought he was a loan officer and you forgot
a
word.
Oh, shoot. Maybe it's now I gotta research again.
His name might just be Basil.
I feel like I generally do a decent job researching, but perhaps not.
His name might just be Basil.
I like Basil. Isn't that like the name of like a detective?
Hold on.
In the Great Mouse Detective.
I was just going to say the Great Mouse Detective, there's a Basil. But I was like, I'm going to sound stupid saying that.
Sounded stupid, so I'll take that.
I love that movie.
It's so good. Radigan used to scare me, though.
The bat, in the beginning, he scared me.
Oh my god, I forgot about him. I think I blocked him out. Oof. Ed, are you researching his name?
I am, but I'm. There's so many variations of his name that...
Thank you.
There is a John Secunda fried chicken in Dover, New Jersey.
Oh, sign me up.
Yeah, I'll have to look into this and get back to
you. Yeah, so I'm not completely
I hope he's a loan officer.
I hope named Ion. All right, collect yourselves, people. So we abandoned the lead with John, Basil, Ion, loan officer guy. So the next suspect I think we need to cover is Lois. Did she have something to do with Michelle's disappearance? To be honest, it doesn't sound like police ever really looked into that lead, but that's only from like newspapers. So I don't know for sure, but there was nothing written about that. And maybe it just wasn't reported on, but I think it's an incredibly valid theory after listening to Justine's interview on the Crime Pursuit podcast.
What did she think? She was...
Whoa. Kate, you.
I was going to say, she was the one in the hospital, right?
Yeah, her mother, for lack of a better word. Giver.
So what did Justine think about her mom's possible involvement?
I mean, she said kind of what I stated earlier, just that, you know, the siblings often ask themselves, could she have done this? And, you know, what else? Like, what about Lois's kind of child sex ring she had going on with finding her daughter's quote-unquote boyfriends?
She may not have done it.
That's another thing I wanted to ask. Back in 1986, or even a few years later, I don't know, was any of this reported? The child abuse, the sex rings, all of this crazy stuff. Was this not even talked about until the podcast?
That's the first time that I heard of it was.
So maybe this wasn't thing then because they had no idea.
It did say
Don't forget, I think that they were terrified of her. So I don't think that they would have brought that up. Right, so
probably would never even question that because no one would have spoke up at that point, I don't think.
She temporarily lost custody, though, at some point. But was that after?
It was when Michelle was still with the family.
Hmm. Oh, okay. So but there could have been...
But here's the thing. She lost custody in a different state. Then they moved to Pennsylvania, and Pennsylvania really failed them. They just kind of gave them back to their mom, and they moved, and that was the end of that. No one followed up. And I think that that was a big thing. Especially in the 80s and maybe 90s, I don't know about today, but, you know, like the paper trail kind of ends when you go to a different state sometimes. And I think as sick as it is, people fall through the cracks, unfortunately.
Right.
So, I mean, with Lois's child sex ring, Michelle was 11. Did Lois sell her to someone? Did something happen? Did, you know, like there's just so many what ifs. And in addition to really all of the horrible things Lois did, one thing she didn't seem to do was grieve her missing child. According to Justine, she didn't act like the mother of a missing child. She really didn't seem fazed. And Justine and her siblings were in constant fear that they could potentially disappear like Michelle Jolene did. And there was actually a story about how the morning that Lois got out of the hospital, she didn't go home and hug her children. She went out to breakfast with her daughter's boyfriend, not the daughter, but the daughter's boyfriend and her husband at the time. So, I mean, when I came home from the hospital, the first thing I did was come home and hug my dogs and tell them I love them. So, you guys are parents. Would that not be your first move?
I would think.
Definitely my first move.
Right? All right, let's leave Lois in the dust because she's foul and I don't want to talk about her anymore. But
one more thing before you ask. One more thing.
Okay, go ahead.
Is she still alive?
No. I believe she died in 2020.
Okay.
Did they mention if she had any mental, like, diagnosed mental health issues?
They didn't say, at least it wasn't in any of the articles that I read. But again, like, this abuse didn't really come out until she was after she had passed away. So, next suspect, and I don't know if he was ever really considered a suspect, but what about her dad, Isaac? Remember, I had said that he had been estranged from the family for several years. And here's the crazy part. He wasn't made aware of Michelle's disappearance for several months after she had gone missing. Like, he had no idea. I do know he was difficult to find. In fact, Lois had been chasing him down for child support for a while. But the fact that he just didn't know is just, that's just crazy. Because I feel like parents are always the first suspects, you would think, in child disappearances, child abduction cases. Like, I feel like they usually look at the ones closest to them first.
Did I mishear you, or did you call her dad Isaac?
It's Isaac Woody Lakey.
Robert?
No, there's no Robert. That was in one article, and then all the other articles said Isaac Woody.
Okay.
So,
okay.
Unless he's like John and has several aliases.
Yes. Okay.
But yeah, that is in my notes. I didn't change it.
So I have a question. I want to go to two ends of this. One, I think.
Okay.
He is estranged for this long. He knows what was going on, and he was too, for lack of better terms, coward to do anything or to his children. Or two, maybe he was the one in the little yellow car and drove her away to freedom.
Maybe.
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 But we do visit, like, talk about him a little bit later, so.
Okay.
Why only her, though, and not any of the other kids? Or, you know what I mean? Right. Yeah. I would need more, like, context to kind of be able to decide if I would think he's a suspect or not.
Agreed. So no one, apparently no one knew where he was, and it took several months for the Scranton PD and the FBI to actually locate him. He was living in Texas at the time of her disappearance. He was interviewed in May of 89, so not quite 3 years after she went missing. And he was interviewed in the article that talked about them digging on Route 307. He stated that he, quote, did not believe his daughter was dead, end quote. So I don't know what that means. Read into that what you will. One of the digging sites, which I forgot to mention earlier, one of the digging sites on PA 307 was actually where the burning body of 9-year-old Renee Waddle was found. So that is one of the reasons why they were there. But again, we don't know if they found anything. So back to Isaac. He also mentioned in that article that he had not had contact with his daughter in 10 years. And remember, wow, she was only 11 at the time of her disappearance. So
it's terrible.
Again, there was really no, I mean, even in the interview, I believe Justine referred to him as Mr. Lakey. So, I don't think there's
you wonder if there was ever any guilt for that, for just not being a part of her life, and then she's just gone.
There would have to be, right?
I would think.
You would think.
It sounds like there wasn't really even a relationship, though, because if he was out of her life by the time she was a year old, I mean, what would the motive be to come and kidnap her?
Right.
Right. And again, just her. Why just her? Like you said. All right, so our last suspect. What is the connection between Michelle and Frank Ossolini? Well, Frank admitted to knowing Michelle, and actually, she would have probably passed at least one of his garages on her walk home that August 26th. And he admitted to knowing her and that she would also often visit him at his auto body shop. And he had given her rides home in the past, supposedly. According to multiple news articles, he had two garages in Scranton. I searched property records, and I actually came across several addresses, three different ones, but they were basically all between the hospital and Michelle's home. So I'm not sure if two of them were the garages and one was his home. I do remember one of these garages was near Joanne Williams' house, who we talked about her in December. But regardless of the correct address, Michelle would have walked super close to or directly past at least one of the garages.
That's what I had thought. I'm sorry, Melissa. I was just going to say that's kind of what I thought in the last episode. Like he used these properties as like his, like, he would just watch for people and kind of scoop up whoever he felt like, whatever fit his need, you know?
Remember Laureen Finn? She was the one who was walking home at like 2:30. Right. And it's like how right could by his someone... place. Yeah. So, who knows? It was also said that Michelle was frequently seen hanging out at one of his garages, and she would stop by and play with his dog. So, you know, we said she was an animal lover, so that doesn't seem out of, like, the realm of possibility. So we know that they knew each other, at least. In the article about digging on Route 307, Michelle's biological father, Isaac, states that he knew that Frank was, quote, well acquainted with the family, and it didn't give him a good feeling, end quote, knowing that Frank and Michelle Jolene were close. So what's really bothering me, and I talked about this earlier, did he own a light yellow car? Did he have access to a light yellow car? Did his wife have a light yellow, you know, like, was he test driving a light yellow car? Like, who knows whose car he had at the time that he was fixing or working on?
Well, my question is, was he just close to her? He was not close to any of the other young siblings that would probably walk the same route. It was just her?
Didn't say. Yeah. But if you think about it, she was 11. The little girl that he was convicted of murdering was 9. And I think Michelle looked pretty young, so maybe there's a connection
and
there.
And if the dad was so uninvolved, how in the world did he know who was acquainted with who?
Exactly. I feel like he probably heard that somewhere.
From word of mouth, I would assume. I mean, because he was just, my opinion. Again, I...
No, I agree with you. You know, how do you know if you haven't been around in 10 years? Mm-hmm. But
that is a strange, like, choice of words, though, that he picked. And who knows? He could have, the dad could have possibly, well, you said he was in Texas at the time?
Yeah, and I do believe that they were pretty sure he was in Texas. Gotcha. So,
yeah.
Every year on August 26th, Michelle's family, led by Justine, returns to Scranton, and they walk the route from the hospital to her former home on 1300 North Washington Ave. They call this annual event Walking Jolene Home. I got goosebumps. I got it when I was writing it and reading it just
thing.
Now.
The coolest thing.
It's like they symbolically like finish her walk. Like I just think that's amazing. And Justina, that badass, amazing woman, she started this yearly event back in the early 2000s and they've done it every year since then. So that's incredible. I wish I could just end there, kind of on an uplifting note. But unfortunately, if Michelle's story didn't break your heart, don't worry, I got you. There's a kiosk outside of the Lackawanna County Courthouse. And for years, this kiosk, which was named after Michelle Jolene Lakey, was used to not only highlight Michelle, but also missing children. And this kiosk was full of the bright smiles of these beautiful children. They're like, they're frozen in time. These kids who have missed holidays and birthdays and going to prom and falling in love and just leaving their mark on the world and what they could have been, you know, they're in this kiosk for everyone to see. And Michelle's picture was permanently there, and they would change out the other kids every month. So, you know, people would remember. I think that's so important. And the kiosk was dedicated to Michelle in 2020 by the former administration, spearheaded by the then Lackawanna County Commissioner, Patrick O'Malley. So, O'Malley, you're awesome.
That is awesome.
At the time of the dedication, Patrick stated of Michelle and the kiosk, quote, "This will be a memory of her. She is the guardian angel of this kiosk," end quote.
So cool.
However, sorry, I'm not done. In 2023, so just last year, Justine, Michelle's amazing sister, wrote an opinion piece that was published in the editorial section of the Scranton Time Tribune newspaper. In this piece, she wrote about how currently the kiosk, which brought comfort for her family and kind of gave them a place to grieve, is now empty. The current administration of the Lackawanna County Courthouse made the decision, the heart-wrenching decision, to remove all traces of Michelle and the other children. Justine wrote, and this is really tough, but she wrote, quote, "The kiosk was as empty as our hearts. Only dried glue gave testimony to erasure. The site will haunt me," end quote.
Jesus.
And, like, you can picture that. You can totally picture, like, because I saw a picture of the kiosk, and you can just picture, like, how it used to look versus, like, everything torn down.
So sad.
She went on to say that she has tried multiple times to get the current Board of Commissioners to reconsider. But they have refused thus far, at least as of her editorial piece in June 2023. And honestly, I'd really like to know why they made that move and why they have to be so crappy. So come at me, Lackawanna.
It's just when you don't have, they obviously have, I'm assuming, have come to terms with the fact that she's dead and was likely murdered. Yes. So, but when they're still missing, you don't have that tangible thing, you know, that you can go grieve. You don't have a body that you can bury and a place to go to talk to them and respect them. And so when things like this happen, it's like this kiosk, it was just a kiosk. It was wood and nails and you know what I mean? But to them, it's something mm-hmm. tangible. It's her. So it's extra sad. And I don't think that people take that into consideration when they make these probably either financial based decisions or why ever they chose to take this down.
To have her name on it, like a permanent nameplate, and for someone to yeah. rip that down, y'all are shitty.
Right. Just disrespectful to like it's dedicate.
So disrespectful.
Yeah, right?
Did they take the whole kiosk down or is it the kiosk empty?
No, the kiosk itself is there, but as of June 2023, it was empty. So I'm glad it's was ruined and then being used for nothing.
It's just sitting there?
It's just sitting there. I mean, again, that piece was written in June 2023. I have not been to Scranton since June 2023, so I don't know. But from what I gathered, too, they didn't even tell anyone. Like, I believe that Justine went to put flowers there or something, and everything was gone. Like, they had this huge event to memorialize her and dedicate this kiosk to her. And then the new people just ripped it down.
Awful.
Was there like, some kind of like upkeep or something that they didn't want to do? Or like,
I have no idea.
Because personally, I think the public, because it's not just her, there's multiple children on this kiosk. I think the public correct. Would have, everyone, there have been plenty of people donating, whatever, to keep it up. I'm sure right. that could have been something suggested. So,
and how hard is that to print out new pictures every month? Right. Come on. Well, just to bring you down a little bit more, I want to end this super tragic story with a quote from, actually, it's a beautiful quote from Michelle Jolene's sister, Justine. I think it's something we could all remember. She said, quote, "Pay attention to someone, love them now, it's all that matters," end quote.
So true.
So that is the disturbing, tragic case of Michelle Jolene Lakey, potentially part of the Scranton Five, but I don't know that I think that in this case.
I think I fluctuate. I think Frank did them all, and then I think he did, well, like two of them, and then like, so it's, I don't know. He's a dirty dog.
It's hard.
I don't think I'm sold yeah. on Frank, but I, you know, I wasn't sold on Frank with Laureen either. I think I'm sold. Well, I don't know. I don't think I'm sold on him here, but only because of you mentioning
what
her
else
childhood and what she had to endure. If that mm-hmm. wasn't right. mentioned, maybe.
So sad, because she was so sweet. She was so beautiful. She was fun. As Justine said, she lived out loud. Apparently, one day someone told her something like, "Michelle, your socks don't match." And she responded with, "Good," which I love. To. I'm wearing mismatched socks right now.
Too sassy.
So I thought that was just, yeah, she was so sassy and just so cool. And
it's awesome.
Sucks that she had to endure so much. But again, I think her sister's quote is really beautiful. And hopefully one day there will be answers for Michelle and Justine, too, because she deserves it. She's amazing for keeping her sister alive, like her sister's memory alive, and talking about her and being able to talk about everything they went through.
Pretty awesome. So
that's all we have for this episode of the Keystone Cold Cases podcast. Thank you so much for listening, and please consider leaving us a review wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to find out more about us, the pod, and the cases we cover, or want to suggest a case, please visit us at kccpod.com or send us an email at keystonecoldcases@gmail.com. You can also follow us on Facebook at Keystone Cold Cases and on Instagram and TikTok at KCC Pod.
please remember never to reach out to family or friends of the victim, only to law enforcement if you have any tips. This episode was researched and hosted by me, Melissa. Find all of our sources, social info, and contact information at kccpod.com. Theme music from Darren Makins. Join us again next week for another case to sleuth out.